Very welcome, everyone, and in particular, welcome to Philip. It's great to see you. It's been a while since we last had a chance to meet up, and of course, that's one of the plights of the world today. But I was very pleased to see that you are promoting a new book, which has just been released. It's called Them and Us: How Immigrants and Locals Can Thrive Together. And I can say straight away that this is a really, really good book. It's a book that sort of walks us through a lot of the research and evidence that has been gathered for a long time about not just the economic aspects of migration, but also looking into some of the issues that have popped up quite a lot in the debate over the past years on issues like culture and identity, for instance. It's the perfect book if you want to find a good Christmas gift to people that you think would need to have a solid argument in favor of open societies where also immigrants can come and thrive. But it's also a good book, I think, for people who are already convinced about the benefits of migration, because this gives you a very solid and well-grounded analysis about what we've learned about migration for the past decade. So I'm very pleased to see you, Phil, and very welcome to our event here.
Thank you, Frederick. It's good to be here with you, and I'm looking forward to the discussion.
So let me just start by saying a few words, which is that, first of all, this is not your first book on migration. You've written previously on migration as well, but you've also written on other issues, on, for instance, globalization. You had a few years ago a book out on the European experience of the crises called the European Spring and why we needed to see a change in the economic direction in Europe. But now you're back at migration again, and I wanted to begin by asking you, so why this book and why now?
Well, I wrote my first book on immigration, Immigrants Your Country Needs Them, back in, it was published back in 2007, and that was a completely different world. The economy was booming, it was before the financial crisis, it was before the rise of the far right and populism and so on. So I think merely in terms of the context, the debate had moved on, and you know, unfortunately, one option would have been to update Immigrants Your Country Needs Them, but actually I felt that things had changed so much that a new book was called for. That was the first reason. Second of all, because all sorts of new issues have come up in the discussion. For example, climate change is now front and center in a discussion of migration in the way that it wasn't back then. Or indeed in Europe, the issue of refugees is much more salient than it was back then. Also, as you mentioned just at the start, I mean, there's been a huge amount of new research into both the economic and the social and the cultural aspects of immigration. And given that all my books rely on first-hand interviews and you know, illustrations and stories, but also backed up by solid data, when there was so much more evidence around, it was important to capture that. And I think last but not least, my own understanding of immigration had improved massively. You know, my first book was about globalization. I basically came to the immigration debate as an expert on trade rather than an expert on immigration. So my first book was really starting from first principles, reading lots of stuff, interviewing lots of people, and coming to my own conclusions. Now I've been thinking, writing, indeed set up a think tank called Open to deal with migration issues for the past 13 years. And so my own knowledge of immigration and all the aspects had improved massively. So for all those reasons, whether it was the external political context, whether it was the improvements in the research, or whether it was my own understanding, it felt right to write a new book. And at a time when immigration is so topical, whether it's due to Trump in the US, Brexit in the UK, refugees in Europe, or indeed the coronavirus crisis, where immigrants have played such an important role.
So we are going to basically go through some of the key arguments and the key perspectives you take in the book. But if we start off by, if you just sort of give us a short sort of elevator pitch for the book, what would you say it's about? Or what would you tell to people that haven't read it already, what the book is about?
Yeah, I mean, the debate about immigration is very often pitched as them versus us, of them being sort of bad, threatening immigrants versus us, you know, good, upstanding locals. And I think that that framing of the debate is, you know, misguided, incorrect, dangerous. And actually, the debate ought to be about how we can all thrive together. And therefore, it puts forward a huge amount of economic evidence to show that the contribution that immigrants make primarily to Western societies. Also addresses some of the thorny cultural and social issues that arise around migration and suggests how they can be addressed. Looks at a crucial question, which is the question I most often ask when I do public events, which is, okay, it's all well and good presenting the evidence for immigration, but how do you convince people who are skeptical? And so a lot of work on that. And then, you know, concludes on, I think, an uplifting note, which is to suggest that actually the backlash against immigration that we've seen in recent years, dangerous and threatening as it is not necessarily the end of the story. Actually, there are very good reasons to think that we're heading to a more liberal and cosmopolitan Europe and a liberal and cosmopolitan world. You know, happy to discuss why I think that later in this discussion.
Yes, this is certainly something I would like to discuss a little bit later, because I think one of the great strengths of the book is that it also provides more hope. It's not a dystopian book in the sense that you're confronted sort of just with descriptions of what has been going on in the broader debate in Europe and America over the past couple of years, of course, where there has been sort of a pretty sharp rise in anti-immigration views, and where especially the rise of a couple of populist parties have, I think, disrupted party politics to an extent where it has become difficult for the establishment parties to attain sort of a pro-immigration stance more generally. So let's get back on these notes later. But let us start with the economics here and the economic arguments in favor of migration. You lay out what you called nine dividends, nine economic dividends from migration. And I would like us to have a look at some of them. One of them is on dynamism and economic dynamism more generally. Where does migration plays into the argument of having a dynamic economy?
Well, I think by far the biggest contribution that immigrants make is as entrepreneurs, as entrepreneurs individually, or as entrepreneurs co-founding firms with local people. And it's not just a story about Silicon Valley, impressive as that is, where nearly half of the startups are co-founded by immigrants, and where it includes, you know, really huge names like Google or Tesla or PayPal and so on. It's also true in the UK, where nearly half of the 100 fastest growing companies were co-founded by migrants. It's true also in Germany, a country which is not known for its entrepreneurship, where 42% of new companies are founded by foreigners. And I think there are good reasons why, you know, good reasons why that's true. I mean, when you arrive in a country with, you know, without a conventional career or contacts or capital, starting up on your own is a natural choice to make. At the same time, you're more desperate to get ahead, you're more willing to take the risk of starting a company, and you may spot opportunities that locals don't see precisely because you have diverse perspectives and experiences. And so for all those reasons, you see that immigrants make a really, really outsized contribution. And I think actually what's important about that is that the people who succeed as entrepreneurs are not by and large people who were selected by some government scheme, as exists in many countries, of startup visas for would-be entrepreneurs. They are people who arrive often penniless and without education and go on to great things. And that, for me, is a really powerful example about how so much of immigration actually is about serendipity. It's about creating connections between people. It's around diverse perspectives sparking new ideas, and it's about people who government bureaucrats might write off as being unskilled and useless, actually having a burning desire to succeed and proving everyone wrong.
Indeed, and you have a pretty good example now, right, in the development of new vaccines in the world, where at least one of the prominent candidates, it's this fantastic story about immigrant entrepreneurs, scientists that have developed several type of companies, and now they are leading a German firm who is, together with Pfizer, developing one of the medicines, sorry, vaccines that can help us to get out of this mess.
Absolutely. BioNTech, which is a German biotech startup, where it's a husband and wife team. The husband arrived as immigrant from Turkey with his parents as a child. His wife, also of Turkish origin, was born in Germany. And this is their second health startup. And obviously, if you think of the individual contribution they've made, if it brings forward even by a month, the time at which the world can escape from the coronavirus crisis, then the economic benefits run into trillions of dollars. The second vaccine developed by Moderna in the US, Moderna was created, a US company, to commercialize the research of a Canadian scientist, and it was done in co-founded by a Lebanese-born scientist and investor. So there too is a story about immigration. So, I mean, those benefits run into the trillions and trillions, and they frankly outweigh any potential costs that you could blame on or try to blame on immigrants.
Yeah, no, indeed. Another dividend you point to is on human capital and diploma. So what's the benefit of migration there?
Well, I mean, the education market, and university education in particular, is a booming market. I'm based at LSE's European Institute in London, and the institute itself could not exist without its foreign students. They make the institute viable. They subsidize the local students. They inject spending into the economy. They enable the hiring of top professors and paying all the other staff. They also play a key role in research. You know, as any university professor will tell you, it's the postgrads who are helping, are doing the heavy lifting in the research. And of course, many international students then stay on, and having the benefits of coming from abroad and a local education are particularly valuable to locally based firms in knowledge industries that rely on people with human capital. So, and obviously, there have been concerns that because of the coronavirus crisis, that the international student market was going to collapse this year, and actually, by and large, it hasn't. And I think that trend is going to continue.
I test one idea on you here. I mean, something which I've spent some time working on over the past couple of months, and well, indeed years, which is on, I mean, especially for many economies in Europe now, I mean, one critical challenge they have is to make sure that their economies are brought to the technological frontier, that you have the capacity to move with technology and that you can incorporate new innovations, new technologies in a way that helps to improve your chances of in competition on the global market. And it's pretty striking to me, sort of, with the huge supply shortages we have with educated labor in Europe, especially in computer engineering, AI, etc., that there is an enormous case to be made here for keeping your borders open to people who want to come here and to bring human capital and bring knowledge of the kind that it's critically important in order to get various types of economic organizations to actually be able to move to the technological frontier. In that sense, that sort of the case for open borders and for migration actually gets stronger when you have technological shifts of the kind that we have today. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And you can see that in the case, you know, of the United States. I mean, if you think, if there's one country which you think might be able to rely on homegrown labor, it's so huge, it's so vast, it's so advanced, it's such great resources. If one country might be able to make a go of it, you think it would be the United States. And actually you see that, you know, Silicon Valley is powered by foreign talent. You can see that more than half of the computer science PhDs in the United States come from abroad. Here in Europe, you see that, you know, more than half of the scientists in Switzerland come from abroad. And so when you're looking even at, you know, a homegrown company in Europe, which looks like the epitome of, you know, a German or a Swedish or a Swiss or a British or a French company, you'll find very often that the research and development is being done by teams of foreigners and locals, and that's absolutely crucial to that company's success. And so we talk a lot about you know, the globalization that takes place from firms operating overseas. We talk much less about the globalization that happens, you know, within companies domestically, from that mixture of foreign and local talent, which is so crucial. And that brings me to, I mean, I'm sure you're going to come onto it, to what I call the diversity dividend, which is, you know, really, really important. And it's so often missed in the debate, which is, you know, immigrants are looked at individually, and, you know, government bureaucrats judge them on, do their skills add up to what we're looking for? Do they meet the grade? And actually the biggest benefits of migration often happen from the combination of immigrants and locals are sparking off each other. Again, there's a huge amount of evidence on that. You can see, for example, that, you know, American scientific papers that are co-authored by foreigners and Americans tend to be cited more often. You can see that European regions that are more diverse, their companies tend to be more productive. You can see that within companies, those that are more diverse tend to innovate more, and so on. You can see it actually even in football. And I know that you're a Liverpool fan. I'm a long-suffering Arsenal fan, but you can see that in Liverpool, you know, arguably the best team in Europe, or at least certainly the best team in England, and they were world champions as well. And what's striking is about the combination of foreign players gelling with each other, which goes against what many people think, which is, well, if you're going to play as a team, you all need to, you know, think alike, be alike, and you're going to gel better. And actually, it's that combination of different players from different countries and different playing styles, actually, which is more effective.
Indeed, I was actually going to ask you towards the end. could use a Liverpool example, but there you go. Very good. No, and it's we can talk for ages about Liverpool and what the influence that people from different parts of the world have had on not just the performance of the team, but also on the academy and how you train young people in football. But that's for another conversation. Demography. I mean, Europe is a continent where several countries are facing sort of the prospects of a declining population, where labor supply is generally going to go down, where we have increasing number of elderly people that will need to be looked after by elderly care workers, etc. Now, it's obvious sort of that one route out of this demographic problem is to have people moving here from other countries and joining our labor force. And this is also what we've been seeing, right, in quite a lot of countries over the years. I mean, I'm always sort of struck when I visit a hospital or sort of the elderly care center where my grandparents live. Were usually migrants who was working there, and they also did a fantastic work, sort of a kind that I would doubt that many locals in my country would do if they were the only ones working there. So is there sort of a dividend here on demography, which isn't just about substituting declining numbers of people in Europe, but also that we're substituting with them with people that have the capacity to do the type of work that very few people are interested to do, or at least far too few people are interested to do in our countries today.
I think the demographic dividend is absolutely crucial. Young immigrants tend to be young, and they can help both care for and pay for the growing ranks of elderly Europeans, increasing numbers of whom will need care. They will also complement Europeans in the labour force because they tend to be young, and the biggest aspect of the demographic decline is among Europeans aged 20 to 30, and so therefore they will complement older, more experienced Europeans in the labour force. And I start off the chapter on the demographic dividend by visiting Japan, which has been loath to allow in immigrants for basically cultural and racial reasons, and where Japan being perhaps the oldest society on Earth, and where therefore they ploughed loads of money into develop robots to care for the elderly as a substitute. And what they found is that, you know, there is a role for robots, they can't substitute for many aspects of human care. And as a result of that, the fiercely nationalistic former Prime Minister Abe decided actually that you needed to open up to foreign care workers, and there's a huge expansion of that going on. Or you can see that in parts of Europe which are already suffering from a demographic decline, in Italy, where more than half of the care workers are immigrants, or indeed in East Germany, where refugees have helped to repopulate dying towns and thereby keep key facilities like the local school open. And I think that a demographic change happens gradually and then therefore slowly, and so you sort of slowly get used to it. But I think people are not quite aware as how big a shift is going to happen over the next 20 years and how hard it will be to manage without immigrants, whether that is in terms of working in care homes, which young Europeans don't want to do by and large, or whether it is as additional taxpayers to pay the pensions. And Sweden has a very admirable pension system whereby the pension benefits to pensioners depend on the size of the labour force and therefore on their contributions, and therefore there is a direct connection between the benefits of migration and the pensions that older people enjoy. But that is going to be a huge issue in Europe going forward. You've seen millennials who have suffered the brunt of the coronavirus crisis, who are going to otherwise be asked to pay for the growing ranks of baby boom pensioners who've arguably in many respects had a much easier job in recent decades, and that's going to be a huge political challenge, and immigrants can play a huge role in addressing it.
And I suppose it's a similar type of argument that you have when it comes to dealing with the debt situation that we've built up in many Western countries as well, right? That when you look at the amount of debt that every young person now basically needs to take care of, it just becomes sort of a impossible. They're not just going to save for their own pensions and their own future, but they're also going to deal with huge cohorts of people who are retired, and then of course service all the debt that we've shored up. Is that sort of the case for migration in a debt perspective?
Well, yes. I mean, the OECD and others have done studies on the fiscal impact of migration, and they come out with the conclusion that it is a small net benefit, i.e. that the tax revenues that migrants pay tend to be slightly greater than the benefits of public services that they take out. And that's true on a flow, in a flow sense, but actually in a stock sense, if you've got a huge stock of public debt, and after this coronavirus crisis, we have a particularly large stock of that, and you boost the number of taxpayers, by 10%, then you reduce the debt burden on every taxpayer by 10%. And that is a very sizable boost. And it runs into thousands of euros per person. And that is almost entirely lacking in the public debate, and is a really significant fiscal benefit of migration.
All right. So there are a few other dividends that you talk about in the book as well, Phil, and perhaps we can just sort of go over them then quickly. I can put them to you right away, and you can talk about them. And then I'd like us to go into sort of a broader discussion around the economy and migration. But you talk about the deftness dividend, the drudgery dividend, which may sound a bit surprising. What is that, the drudgery dividend?
Well, I mean, drudgery means, you know, hard, unpleasant work. And the drudgery dividend is the work that immigrants often do in dull, difficult and relatively dangerous jobs, whether it is construction, cleaning, and or picking fruit, packing fruit, stacking supermarket shelves. And I think one of the positive aspects of the coronavirus crisis, and there aren't many, but one of them, hopefully, is that it's given people much greater appreciation of the people who were previously dismissed as, you know, unskilled workers, you know, with very little to contribute, seen as a burden or a threat, actually are the people who keep society moving during lockdowns. They are the people who enable other people to keep going. They're the people who clean hospitals. They're the ones who are disinfecting public transport. They are the ones who are delivering food or keeping your supermarket stocked up. And they play a really, really important role. I mean, in any society, there are people who do more skilled work and people who do less skilled work. And those jobs are complementary. And to dismiss those who are doing essential work that most of us wouldn't want to do as somehow unskilled and useless is completely untrue. And hopefully, as I said, the coronavirus crisis has created a greater appreciation of the work that is done. And it is also emphasized how people doing those jobs really, really are not substituting for local workers in any way, sense, shape or form. If you want to test the hypothesis that if only there weren't immigrants, that Europeans would be working in agriculture, picking fruit and vegetables, well, this was the year to do it, with, you know, lockdowns and borders shut. And what you found is that, you know, even in an unprecedented crisis, you were not finding young Europeans or hardly any young Europeans going out and saying, actually, I want to go pick asparagus or dig for potatoes. So it's some really, really crucial work that is being done by immigrants in less skilled work.
And deftness, what is the deftness dividend?
Deftness refers to the highly skilled already discussed, who, you know, power so much of our modern knowledge economy, whether it is pretty any much any sector that you can think of.
Yep. All right. I mean, I apologize to anyone who think that sort of we've been almost in a slavish fashion going through sort of point by point in the book, but I wanted us to do it because I think it's a core argument of the book that you lay out, looking at these particular dividends. And it's also, I think, points to the richness of the argument, which is that it isn't sort of a very simple and simplistic exercise where you just look at some of the quantitative factors, or you just take sort of a typical trade point of view in order to understand migration. You go into a lot of qualitative economic consequences of migration and how it helps to shape sort of an atmosphere which is open, it's diverse, it promotes dynamism, etc., which I think is a really good part of the book. Now, what I wanted to ask you, Phil, is basically, I think I would know a few economists who would say, well, you know what, I agree with basically all that you're saying, but I'm still not going to take the argument that migration benefits the economy at large. And they may point to sort of fiscal consequences, or they may point to sort of problems of a lot of migrants becoming unemployed and needs to be supported by the government. What's your argument to those?
Well, I mean, there are all sorts of reasons why people are opposed to migration, from economic reasons to social and cultural reasons, or just sheer racism and xenophobia. In terms of the economic consequences, I deliberately organize the book in terms of economic dividends that begin with D, because I want, obviously, to for ease of exposition, but also because so often this debate is framed entirely negatively. And so, you know, you address the issue of the contribution that immigrants make in terms of, you know, essential, less skilled, unpleasant work, solely in terms of, well, what is the impact on local workers? And the answer to that is, you know, broadly speaking, it tends to be slightly positive. And that kind of misses out the crucial bit about, well, what about the contribution they make from the work that they're doing and the products and services that they're contributing? So that's the reason I focus it that way. Now, in terms of the specific questions, in terms of the impact on local workers, broadly speaking, it tends to be slightly positive. If you look narrowly on at the labour market and ignore all the broader effects, which is that, you know, it tends to slightly boost local wages and it tends to slightly boost local employment, you tend to see that, say, if someone comes in from a developing country and goes into a menial job in a northern European country, the consequence of that is that the locals who used to do the menial job shift into doing slightly better paid, slightly higher skilled work. And that in turn obviously has a fiscal benefit in terms of they're now doing slightly better paid work than before. And that also tends to be ignored in the public debate. In terms of the fiscal consequences, as I've already mentioned, in a flow sense, the OECD, which has done, you know, the most rigorous cross country studies, tend to show that it's slightly positive. But again, that study, as most studies do, ignore the stock effect, which means that actually, if, you know, at the moment the public debt in a country is, say, 20,000 euros per person, even if the flow effect, even if the person is slightly more costly in an annual sense to the public exchequer than they pay in taxes, actually there's still a net benefit because they're reducing the debt burden per person. Now, there are big variations across countries in terms of those effects, which depend to a large extent on the nature of local labour markets. So in countries with flexible labour markets, such as the United States and the United Kingdom, you tend to find that immigrants have higher employment rates than locals. In countries which have more highly regulated labour markets, or markets where higher skill levels are required for relatively menial work, including all sorts of qualifications which may or may not be necessary. So, for example, in France, if you want to collect rubbish, you need to be able to speak fluent French. It's not obvious to me that that's an essential qualification to do that. Then, obviously, that can be an issue for immigrants who may struggle to find jobs that they otherwise would be able to do. And that, in turn, obviously, can trap them in unemployment, and that, in turn, can, you know, cause fiscal costs. And that in turn can lead to, you know, those immigrants being blamed for what is basically a public policy issue of a labour market which doesn't function as well as it should. And in terms of, you know, the broader social and cultural things, I think we should address those individually, because I could talk about that for like half an hour.
Yeah. Before we go there, just to follow up with a question here, which is from someone who's listening to this conversation, and he's from Germany, and he asks, so the debate in Germany has moved quite a lot. 5 years ago, we talked about how migrants were depressing wages in Germany. Now we just talk about migrants causing crime and instability in our societies. That change, does it mean sort of that the argument that migration push down wages for natives was wrong to start with?
Well, the evidence across countries is basically, and you know, it goes against common sense, because most people tend to think, well, if you have an increase in the supply of labor, that's going to drive down wages. But of course, an increase in the supply of labor also tends to lead to an increase in investment, and therefore any tendency to lower wages is actually offset. And if you add the complementarities between different types of labor, whether it's skilled and unskilled, foreign and local, and the change to capital, you tend to find a small positive effect. So yes, despite the how that often features in political debate, there is scarcely any evidence anywhere that migrants depress wages. Any studies that find that, the effect is vanishingly small. And in terms also of the impact on crime, of course, you know, some immigrants are locals, some immigrants are criminals regressively, just as some locals are. But on average, immigrants tend to commit less crime than locals do. So, you know, that is just a myth. Now, of course, there can be shocking incidents, and you can always point to an anecdote and you can say, well, what that individual person who happened to be done abroad did is absolutely terrible. And that's, of course, that's true. And I agree with that. But it's absurd to then tar all immigrants with the same brush. If a person born in Germany commits a crime, you don't therefore say, well, all people born in Germany are wicked because that one person did. You need to look at things in the round. That's not to excuse the few immigrants who do commit crimes, but it's to say that they're not representative.
All right. But would you agree sort of with that general characterization of the debate that sort of the type of anti-immigration views that we had until 5 years ago or so, which mostly sort of economic arguments in the sense that they either sort of took our jobs or they pushed down our wages or they weren't working at all because they had an ability to live off the government. But now it seems to be much more of a cultural discussion, which have prompted at least some politicians and some political parties to become more skeptical in their views about migration. You think that is that a right characterization of how the debate has changed?
Yeah, I mean, I think the debate has shifted. I think one of the reasons for that is that many people whose real objection to immigration was, you know, if you want to put it kindly, cultural, if you want to put it less kindly, xenophobic, found it easier to express that objection by putting forward economic objections than cultural ones. So it's easier to say, I'm worried about that person with a brown face pushing my wages down or, you know, reducing my access to the doctor, than it is, I just don't want to live next to someone who has a brown face. And so I think part of that is that, you know, with the rise of far-right populism, with the Brexit referendum, with the impact of the refugee crisis in Europe, with the election of President Trump, that views which were beyond the pale now can be expressed much more openly. And I think clearly, from a political point of view, they're much more emotionally powerful arguments. Saying that they depress your wages is kind of, you know, threatening. Saying that they're going to destroy our way of life or commit terrible crimes is much more emotionally powerful.
And to connect that also with a question that comes from one of those participating here in Zoom, do you think there's also geopolitical dimension in this, or something which at least relates to our own self-confidence of being sort of a powerful economic or powerful political region in the world? And I think that you can apply that to America as well, of course, that, you know, we're getting many more people who are skeptical of migration simply because we're not that confident about ourselves anymore.
I think that's very true. I think that many people within society have lost socioeconomic status, or feel they've lost socioeconomic status, or fear that they will in future lose social economic status. And on top of that, you know, if you were bottom of the pile in Europe before, you could at least look down at the rest of the world and say, I'm comfortably above them. And actually now you can see China and other countries which are coming up behind and threatening to overtake. And therefore, that increases the feeling of anxiety. And I would turn the argument around and say, well, you know, if we are to continue prospering in the 21st century, where Europe is going to matter less in almost any scenario demographically and economically, and then one key advantage that we have or can have is open liberal societies which allow different people to spark off each other and to thrive. And if we don't want to become simply a huge retirement home eating away our capital, then those young foreigners are an absolutely crucial element of that. And that's something which, except on a very tiny scale, China is unlikely, it's a strategy that China is unlikely to be willing or able to follow.
Now, you write quite a lot in the book, which I think it's also one of the strengths in the book, that you go into all these sort of arguments that is often heard now against migration, which are arguments based on culture, identity, type of issues. Now, I find some of these arguments against migration to be difficult to understand in the first place. I mean, I can understand sort of that in the broad abstract of things, you can see sort of that there are cultural differences between, you know, someone growing up in northern part of Sweden as I did, and someone who sort of grew up in Syria. I mean, of course, we come from different cultures and different understandings. But every time you try to understand the argument a little bit more, it becomes difficult, almost sort of cartoonish in a way, that some people make the argument that it becomes difficult to exert your own culture and your own cultural expression simply because there are people from a different culture that lives next to you. But I can't point to sort of any society where that actually happens. I mean, societies that I know quite a lot, like the Swedish society, or Nordic societies, or the UK society, it's not sort of generally a problem for people to express their own Swedishness or Britishness, even if there are a lot of other people living there. So could you help me here? What is the cultural argument against migration about?
Well, I would say that many people are nostalgic for the past. They're nostalgic for the past when they were young and they look back fondly on those years, and when Europe was less diverse than it is now, and they attribute or associate many of the things that they don't like about Europe today to immigrants, and in a sense they would like to turn back at the clock. And I think the power of nostalgia, it's epitomized by Make America Great Again, Donald Trump's slogan. And obviously, those are very, very powerful arguments. Well, I mean, it's also captured by the Brexit take back control kind of thing, as in we had control before, we don't anymore. And those are very, very powerful emotional arguments. But like you say, if you start looking at the facts, I mean, one of the reasons, or the biggest reason why European societies are much, much more diverse than they were before, well, there are two that have very little to do with immigration. The first is due to the 1960s and the revolution of social liberalism, women's rights, gay rights, people feeling much, much freer to reject tradition and live life as they please. Secondly is globalization, but not the globalization of people, but the globalization more generally, whereby, all the products that we find in the shops or the culture that we consume or, the films that we watch and so on is much more international than it was before. I mean, you can just see, for example, the top pop band in the world is a Korean K-pop band, which certainly wouldn't have been the case in the Sweden that you were growing up in. And I agree with you, but I don't think there is anything to stop a liberal, diverse society living together peacefully and productively, and everyone pursuing their own tastes and interests and forming their own identity and valuing different things, provided we all stick by the rules of liberal democracy, which is, that the rules are set by elected politicians, and when those politicians lose, they leave office gracefully, unlike someone we could mention, and that if you want to change the law, you campaign to do so peacefully, or through the ballot box, not by planting bombs. And that, for the most part, people agree that even if you don't agree with the law, you have to respect it. And that basically provides the basis for a peaceful coexistence. You don't need to agree with your neighbor. You might not like their lifestyle choices, but you each mind your own business and get on with your life. And hopefully you can also find connections with your neighbor as well. And I agree with you. It doesn't seem to me that there is any obstacle to that. The same, I mean, if you define national identity as being purely something about, inverted commas, blood, about ethnicity, then yes, it cannot incorporate people who came from different countries. But all European countries, more or less, or most European countries, have moved towards a civic notion of identity, which is of national identity, which is based on clearly local rules and traditions, but doesn't mind where you particularly came from, and which does, of course, involve local cultural characteristics. So, for example, in Germany, you speak German, and in Sweden, you speak Swedish, but otherwise is based around principles about how society should be organized, whether it is liberal democracy or tolerance of differences. And I think, you very well can accommodate a country where some people are fervently nationalistic and other people aren't, as long as you don't try and impose your views on others. That's where the problem comes. And it's a problem which is age old. We had wars of religion before, where people weren't content with saying I'm Catholic or I'm Protestant. If I'm Catholic, everyone has to be Catholic. If I'm Protestant, everyone has to be Protestant. And the answer is, well, no, there is no solution to that. Either you kill each other or you separate. The solution that we found for coexistence is, liberal democracy and tolerance of differences. And it works very well. We focus a lot on the sharp edges of the problem. But for the most part, it enables peaceful coexistence between radically different people, between radical environmentalists and Marxists, between people on the far right and on the far right, on the far left. It's only in a very few limited cases that an issue arises.
Another argument that comes into play here, which is sort of almost a cultural-based argument, or at least an argument which is around problems of integration, is that, and you looked and you commented on this previously, but perhaps we should say something more about it, which is that in some countries, in some metropolitan areas in particular, you can see sort of that there is a linkage between crime networks and gangs and migration, that you've had a general rise of instability in some cities, etc. This is one of the arguments that you can hear quite often now in around Europe, sort of in the sense that you've created migrant cultures which have become very close to crime networks. What would be your argument against that?
Well, I mean, it's certainly true that crime networks can sometimes be based on ethnic links. And obviously the Italian mafia, which then transplanted itself to the United States, is a classic example of that. And nowadays, there are Russian mafias and Albanian mafias and so on. So there is an element of truth to that. But the counter argument to that is that, hardly any immigrants are actually members of those crime networks. And as I said, overall, immigrants are less likely to commit crime than locals. And therefore, the way to address those issues is to target the particular criminals or criminal networks, rather than to tar all immigrants with the same brush. And very often, obviously, these crime networks, which are based on ethnicity, don't necessarily involve migrants. They can involve Colombian gangsters who operate in London, but actually are not resident in London. They're selling cocaine from Colombia, or indeed, you know, Russians who hop on a plane from Moscow. And so the linkage to migration is not always there. But the most important thing is to say, you know, even when you can point to crime networks which are based around ethnicity, one, locals commit crime too, and two, most immigrants don't.
And how do you view, to take sort of an example, and this has been written about quite substantially in the past weeks, of course, after the killing in France of a school teacher who was beheaded because he was depicting the Islamic prophet and teaching pupils about blasphemy. Some would make the argument that, well, you know, this is the price you have to pay if you allow, if you keep borders open and if you have sort of large cohorts of Muslim people who's going to come and live here. They have a radically different view about things that our societies keep sacred, like, for instance, freedom of expression. So in this case, their argument would be there's a conflict here between open liberal societies and the type of migration we have in Europe.
Well, obviously, the atrocities committed by terrorists in the name of Islamist ideology are evil and wrong, and need to be addressed in proportionate and effective and severe in a severe manner. At the same time, there is an evil twin of Islamist terrorism, which is far-right terrorism, and the two kind of feed on each other. They both hate Western liberal societies, and they both seek to undermine them. And actually, the data shows that there are more deaths now from far-right terrorism than there is from Islamist terrorism, which is not to excuse Islamist terrorism at all. It's simply to put it in context. I think the second thing to say is that, you know, while some immigrants or some children of immigrants turn to terrorism, it's a tiny number. It's still far too many, but it's deeply regrettable. It's a tiny number. Most immigrants not only aren't terrorists, but don't sympathize with them. And we have the data that we have show, for example, that among Europeans or indeed among Americans, there is more sympathy for terrorism actually among locals than there is among Muslims. And there's a fractionally higher difference, but not, but there still is one. And that the argument in general that Muslims are extremely illiberal and unable to fit into Western societies isn't true. Now, it's true that on average, they tend to be slightly more social, but they tend to be more socially conservative than people born in Europe. Ironically, in that sense, actually, they're more like their critics on the far right in the sense of their view, their social conservative view of society. As someone who is deeply liberal myself, I find that regrettable. At the same time, what you find is that views shift over time. You find that the children and grandchildren born in Europe tend to be more liberal. Not all are, but tend to be. And that in any case, the numbers are relatively small. Which is not to say that we don't have a problem with illiberalism in Europe. I think we do. I think we have a problem with illiberalism on the far right, and we have a problem with on the Islamist side. And clearly, we need to do much more to address it. But I don't think shutting the borders is the answer. I mean, I grew up in Britain with IRA terrorism. We had bombs going off all the time. And throughout that period, not only were there, you know, not closed borders, but actually people from Ireland could come across the UK without even showing their passport. So it's like the Schengen area in continental Europe. And nobody questioned it. And nobody said, well, just because there is a tiny minority of IRA terrorists, or indeed a larger section of the population in Ireland who do have some sympathy for IRA terrorists, that somehow that we should stop people moving. I think that it needs to be proportionate. It needs to be effective.
Yeah, no, and it's this is a personal anecdote, but when I arrived in Britain as a young student in the early 1990s, I was warned by the university and sort of given suggestions by the university of how we should act in the event of a bomb going off at university. And they weren't talking about Muslim terrorists back then, it was terrorists much closer to home. I think this discussion also relates to sort of the perspectives and ideas that you lay out in the book for the future, and that you also began talking about previously about how different factors are moving us in the direction of sort of open cosmopolitan type of cultures. There are people who take a different view and who would say that, well, you know, it's probable that migration is actually going to go down and that we're not going to become more open as societies, that we're getting older, that we have, and sort of with a lot of more older people around, we're going to become less open to other people, to other cultures. Some would also make the argument that you were alluding to pretty recently, which is that, well, a lot of sort of the migrants that have come, they may change over generations, but they're still pretty conservative in their views, in the sense that they don't like other migrants and they don't like liberal societies. They don't like gay marriage or sort of other parts of social modernization that we've gone through over the past couple of decades. And as a consequence of that, they may sort of join hands with very conservative people in making European societies less open to anything which is different from us and what we are. So if you start by, if you can sort of lay out your optimistic view sort of the future, and then respond to, well, what are your counter arguments to those who suggest that the future is actually going to be different?
Well, I think my concluding chapter is called "The Future is Open." That is obviously a play on words. It's both a hope that it ought to be open, but also a recognition that we don't know whether it's going to be more closed or more open. And I think in the short term, clearly there are strong trends pushing towards greater closure, whether it is the rise of far-right populism, whether it is the perception since the coronavirus crisis that strangers and foreigners in particular are a health risk, whether it is aging societies and nostalgia for a less diverse past, or indeed fears of loss of social economic status from people who used to have good manufacturing jobs, and so on. And certainly you can see that countries can go off into a negative spiral, or indeed go into, the trend is not towards continued openness. And you can see that obviously in the United States, where hopefully the 4-year Trump interlude is an aberration. And you can see that in Britain, where obviously the Brexit is a more enduring mistake with potentially catastrophic consequences. I think the reasons for optimism, though, about the long-term trends are very powerful. I mean, they are what I've already alluded to about the increased demand for foreign talent and the role that plays in economic success, the need for young people in aging societies. And crucially, absolutely crucially, is the vast difference in attitudes between young, predominantly university educated Europeans and older, much less educated Europeans. And there, the shifts are absolutely huge. And so whereas the debate about my migration is often framed, well, it might have economic benefits, but diversity is a cost or a challenge or whatever. Actually, if you ask young people in Europe today what their view about openness is, and openness not to other Europeans, but openness to people from poorer countries outside Europe, and you'll find that young university educated, better educated, are much, much, much more positive, which I think, given that ultimately the young people are going to reshape politics, that what we're seeing now with populism potentially is the last hurrah of an older generation, which wants to turn the clock back, and that, you know, young people potentially actually after the coronavirus crisis, where they're being made to pay so much of the cost of protecting the elderly, say enough, we want a different kind of society. And you can see inklings of that in politics around Europe with the rise of green parties or liberal parties, which are openly much more enthusiastic about migration often than mainstream centre-right or centre-left parties, which were, you know, more ambiguous about it. And potentially, therefore, creating a much more open future in future. And I think part of the task for people who believe in openness and liberal societies such as ourselves is to try to win over the moderate skeptics. And that is not by pandering to xenophobia or to racism, but to try to persuade people who are open to persuasion. And that means not just using facts and arguments, but also stories, anecdotes, and emotional arguments. It means appealing to people with different values. So in the book, I make an argument that you need to make a patriotic case for migration. I mean, I'm not a nationalist in any way, shape or form. Many people are patriotic. Most people are patriotic and want what's right for their country. That doesn't necessarily mean that they need to be anti-immigration. If you can make a case that, you know, immigration can make your country greater and stronger, then you can appeal to people for whom patriotism is incredibly important. It's about encouraging people to mix, where, you know, the most powerful impact on people's views is when the other onto whom you project your fears and fantasies, you actually meet the other and you realize that it's a human being like you with whom you have things in common. And that tends to change your view, not just of the individual, but of the group. And on top of that, better government policies like I've partly alluded to, and a more responsible politics whereby mainstream center-left and center-left parties, center-right and center-left parties, which all too often try and pursue far-right populist votes, thereby legitimizing those far-right views, ought instead to follow the Joe Biden strategy and to reject far-right populism in order to defeat it.
All right. Thank you very much, Phil. I think that also served as a very, very good closing statement, a word of optimism. And I think there are lots of other things that you also point to in the book, which I suggest, or at least I would propose, is a good basis for thinking positively about the future, and not just sort of about the facts and the arguments that you enroll, but also looking sort of at the broader picture of societies being successful and societies being able to address sort of some of the key challenges they're all facing. And that work is certainly not going to be easier if they close the borders to migrants, or if they try to go sort of in manners that are highly nationalistic, or at least based on the notion that they don't need to have people from other cultures and other countries coming to them. The book is called Them and Us: How Immigrants and Locals Can Thrive Together. And as I said, this is a perfect Christmas book to give to anyone you think need a stronger argument in favor of migration, or if you have, as Phil pointed to towards the end, a moderate skeptic who needs to sort of learn more and get a different account of migration. This is also a very good good book for them. It's not just a book for those of us who already are convinced. Let me also say thank you in the first place to you, Phil. Thanks for writing a great book. Thanks for taking the time to join us here this afternoon. Let me also thank those of you who have watched and listened on different platforms. I know that there were a lot more comments and questions that were put to me that we didn't have a chance to go into. But this is far from a discussion that is going to end with this particular event. It's going to, I think, live with us for quite some time. And I'd like us to come back in the future to discuss the same issues we've discussed today, because I think they are vitally important for the future of Europe and the future of the West. So thank you to all of you. Thanks, Phil. Have a good afternoon and see you soon again.